see you. Many years ago, a wise old king called all of his wise men together, and he said, I want you to go out and compile for me the wisdom of the ages. I want you to put it in bound book form so we can leave it to posterity. They went out and they worked a long time. They came back and they had 12 huge volumes. And the wise old king looked at it and he said, well, I'm confident that is the wisdom of the ages, but that's too lengthy, condensed it. People won't read all of that. They came back this time with one huge volume. And again, the wise old king said, still too long. Got to condense it. They came back with just a chapter, then a page, then a paragraph, and finally with a sentence. The wise old king looked at the sentence and he said, now that's it. That is truly the wisdom of the ages. And as soon as all men everywhere learn this, we will have solved many of our problems. The sentence simply said, there ain't no free lunch. Now the wise old king literally hit the nail on the head. When men learn that if they want to occupy their places in the sun, they'll have to expect some blisters, then much will have been accomplished. Work is the price we pay to travel the highway of success. We can best guard against losing our shirts by keeping our sleeves rolled up. And many people believe success is dependent upon the glands. And of course, they're right if we're talking about sweat glands. America was built by people who worked and pulled on the oars, not by those who rested on the oars. I'm going to be so bold as to suggest that if you'll stop your recording now and turn it back and listen to that again, you'll be well advised to do so. There's a tremendous amount of thinking behind that concept. Somebody once wrote that work is the foundation of all business, the source of all prosperity, and the parent of genius. Work can do more to advance youth than his own parents, be they ever so wealthy. It is represented in the humblest savings and has laid the foundation of every fortune. It is the salt that gives life its savor, but it must be loved before it can bestow its greatest blessings and achieve its greatest ends. When loved, work makes life sweet, purposeful, and fruitful. Since the beginning of time, we've all agreed there ain't no free lunch. People in government, education, religion, industry, doesn't make any difference. They've all agreed there ain't no free lunch. And then for some reason, we decide to legalize horse racing, dog racing, casinos, state lotteries. And no wonder then our kids are confused. One minute we're saying, you got to work. And the other we're saying, now let's gamble our way to prosperity. Well, a wise man observed that the success family has work as the father and integrity as the mother. Now, if you've been following me all the way through, you might long about now be saying, now, wait a minute, Ziegler, daggone, you're fast-talking, cotton-picking hide. You've been leading me all through these sessions, and you've told me that we've got to have a good, solid foundation, and I agree with that. You got to have goals, and you got to have a desire. I agree with all of those things. Now, are you telling me after I've done all of that that I got to work, too? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying you gotta do. The most beautiful philosophy in the world won't work if you won't. Education and motivation cover a lot of ground, but they won't cultivate any of it. That just happens to be a fact of life. And work started very early. You know, a lot of people don't realize it. But when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, they weren't there to pick and eat the fruit. They were there to tend the garden. They were put there to work from the very beginning. So we're going to keep on talking about it. We need to start early. We expect our children to accomplish and then give them everything so there's no need to accomplish anything in life. There's an ancient Jewish proverb that says, if you don't teach a man a trade, you raise a thief. I believe there's some validity to that observation. William Bennett, the Secretary of Education, in a New York Times article, made this observation. One of the unutterable truths of the education issue is that there is actually no correlation between funds expended on education and educational excellence. In other words, you got to do more than buy an education. Facts are facts. From 1960 to 1985, national expenditures on education have nearly tripled as SAT scores have plummeted. Some of the most expensive school systems in the country have shown themselves to be among the least effective. The nation's parochial systems are cheap by comparison with their public counterparts. But who can doubt that they are more effective? As has been demonstrated time and again, listen to this, education depends on motivation and the formation of good work habits. The most precise predictor of educational achievement is neither money nor class size, but the quality of homework assigned and completed. All of this was well established most recently in the Education Department's publication, What Works, Research About Teaching and Learning. That's what they've discovered. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm not here to take out after educators or our educational system. So I don't think we've got an educational problem. I think we've got a societal problem. But because that's part of society, we just need to understand that even after we've invested billions of dollars in schools, we're still going to have to work in order to separate the information from the book it's in and put it into the minds of the students. You teach a student early and we learn this lesson ourselves, because this next sentence is profound. Now, as you know, I always tell people when I'm about to say something profound. And the reason I do is because I learned many years ago that an incredibly high percentage of my audiences do not recognize my profound statements as being profound if I don't tell them in advance. And I just don't want anybody to miss this profound statement, but here it is. You never work for somebody else. Never. Now, somebody else might write your check and might sign your check, but the truth is you work for yourself. Inasmuch as you're the one who will eventually determine what the amount they fill in that check is going to be. We need to learn that and we need to teach it. Every job is a self-portrait of the person who did it. Like the portrait painter who signs his name, we should autograph our work with excellence. When you do more than you're paid to do, you will eventually be paid more for what you do. One of the great privileges I had was to learn some important lessons as a child. My mother, in the latter stages of her life, often said that she deeply regretted that her children had had to work so hard when we were children. Each one of us assured her repeatedly that one of the great benefits we had was the privilege of learning to work early on. And I think we finally persuaded her of that. But I was working in a grocery store there in Yazoo City, Mississippi, during the Depression. Literally, 90 to 95% of our business was done between about noon on Friday and 11 o'clock on Saturday night. That's when the farmers came in and bought their supplies, and all of the people who lived in town would get paid on Friday, and that's when they had their money, and things were awfully, awfully tight. We would attempt to buy the amount of food, groceries that is, in the store that the boss thought we would sell that week. They just didn't carry much inventory. We often would run out. The stores then would borrow from each other. There's a young fellow named Charlie Scott that worked across the street. He was the runner for that store. I was the runner for our store. Charlie Scott hit that front door of ours, I'll bet you, 10,000 times when I was a child. He'd hit the front door running. He'd say, "Mr. Anderson, I need to borrow a half dozen cans of tomatoes." Mr. Anderson, the owner of the store, would say, "Well, Charlie, you know where they are. Go get them." Old Charlie would be in a dead run. He'd go back there and he'd snatch the six cans of tomatoes off the shelf. He would scoot back up to the counter. He'd plop the tomatoes down. He'd scribble his name on the receipt Mr. Anderson had signed. He'd snatch those tomatoes back up and he'd be off in a dead run. And one day I finally said, "Mr. Anderson, how come Charlie Scott's always in such a hurry?" Mr. Anderson kind of grinned and said, "Charlie's always in a hurry because Charlie's working for a raise. And he looks like he's going to get it, too." I said, "Mr. Anderson, how you know Charlie's going to get a raise?" Mr. Anderson kind of grinned. He said, I know Charlie's going to get a raise, because if the man he's working for doesn't give it to him, I am. It is absolutely true that when you do more than you're paid to do, you will eventually be paid more for what you do. Now, the person you're working for might not do it, but somebody's going to see what you're doing, and they're going to give you the extra that you're going to deserve. It's not pull that makes the difference in life. It really is push that makes the difference. I'm convinced that one of the reasons that we're suffering an import deficit today is because our Japanese counterparts, as an example, are outworking us. Not outperforming us, they're outworking us. As an example, the average Japanese high school graduate has been in the classroom more hours than the average American college graduate. The average Japanese student spends a little over 3 hours a day outside the classroom studying. The average American student spends a little less than 30 minutes a day outside the classroom studying. Now, you could not persuade me that all of those hundreds of extra hours do not make a difference. It's just a fact. They're certainly no smarter than we are, but they're working harder to accomplish their objectives. I'll give you this as an observation, and please, everybody listening to this recording, please understand, now, I'm not talking about your kids when I talk like this, but I am talking about the average kids in America. I just want you to know that when we compare to what's going on. In Japan, you ask the average teenager where he's going to go to university, what company he's going to go to work for, what department he's going to go to work in, what he's going to do, where he'll be 5 years from today, 10 years from today. He can tell you. You ask the average American, and he can tell you how much money Michael Jackson got for the Pepsi commercial. He can tell you how much money Herschel Walker got when he signed his cowboy contract. He can tell you how many records Bruce Springsteen has sold, and he can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, how many home runs Reggie Jackson has hit. But you talk to him about the world of work, and you're talking about an entirely different situation. They're identifying with the world of play. I don't misunderstand. That's not the kids' fault. Now, I'm not fussing at the kids by any stretch of imagination. I just don't know many kids that own movie studios and television studios and record producing studios and that sort of thing. As I understand it, they're owned mostly by us adults. We need to be the ones who are doing the closing. We need to be the ones who are doing the working and the teaching. Unless your company closes or merges, actually, you should never have to look for but one job. And I think that's the message we ought to teach our kids. And you ought to do that job so enthusiastically and so well that, like Charlie Scott, you'll just go on from there. I was in Starkville, Mississippi several years ago at Mississippi State conducting a seminar. I told the Charlie Scott story. When it was seminar was over, this tall fellow walked up to me and he said, when's the last time you've seen old Charlie? And I said, well, gracious, I left Yazoo City in 1944. He was a couple of years older than I was. He left in 42. I haven't seen him since. He said, you probably wouldn't even recognize him, will you? I said, no, I don't guess he would. He said, well, I didn't think so. He said, I'm Charlie Scott. He was a man who was a very wealthy man, according to his friends, retired at age 50 to do exactly what he wanted to do in life. Now, he was able to do that because what he learned as a kid in a grocery store, he applied it all through his work career. He always gave it that extra effort with the expected results. Now, probably the most humiliating thing anybody can do as far as a job is concerned is to lose one that you're overqualified for. And that often happens. You know, you get a job that's absolutely beneath you. I mean, I can go to sleep doing this, and they generally do go to sleep doing it. Now, when you get fired from a job that you're overqualified for, what you going to tell the next future employer? you got fired from this job. You mean it was putting sand in a bag and you couldn't handle that one? Well, let me tell you something. Whatever the job is, the best way to qualify for the next one is to be super good at this one. A number of years ago, we were at dinner one evening, my wife, my son, and myself, and went to a steakhouse. And we walked in and sat down. And the young busboy came in, and he was pouring the water for the glasses. He snatched the glass up off the table, and he doused it in. He picked the other one up, and he doused it in. He picked the other one up, and he doused it in. I watched him kind of intently, and the expression on his face was a sight to behold. When he finished the third one, I said, "Don't like your job, huh?" He said, "No, I don't." I said, "Well, don't worry about it." I said, "You're not going to have it very long." He looked at me in absolute shock, and he said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Young man, let me tell you something. There's not a company on earth that could afford to have you on the payroll if you were paying them to let you work here. With that attitude, I can guarantee you, you're not going to have this job long." He did an abrupt turn around. He walked through the door, and you've seen the old Abbott and Costello movies. He strode through it like he is mad at the world, and then immediately his other one come back this way. He walked out. I mean, it was hilarious. Just the biggest grin on his face, and what a dramatic difference it made. Whatever the job is, give it your best. I know all of you know who Michael Landon is. He's had some incredible series, Bonanza, Highway to Heaven he's starring in now, I believe that's the name of it, and he had another one, Little House on the Prairie. He's recognized. His first job was mixing glue and cutting ribbons in a ribbon factory. Now, how much skill do you need to do that? But Michael Landon said he learned to give that his absolute best, and when he gave it his very best, he said, "You know, I got an enormous amount of satisfaction from it." But the way you get out of a job you don't like is you do it so extraordinarily well that nobody can afford to keep you in that position. In his book, How to Manage Your Boss, George Berkeley suggests that if you're going to do any extra work, if you really want to get ahead, he suggests that you come in early. That indicates an eagerness to get on with the job. Whereas if you stay late, that could mean that you simply could not finish the job. You take enthusiasm to your job and you look for the extra things to get into. Make certain that when you've been with the company 10 years, that you've got 10 years experience, not 1 year's experience 10 times, because that's not the way you get promoted. My friend Steve Brown from Atlanta, who is an outstanding speaker, put it this way. He said, "Remember that anything worth doing is worth doing poorly until you learn to do it well." You see, a lot of times we are hesitant to tackle something because we are uncertain of our skills. But when the employer or the boss says, "I want you to do this," we simply should say, "I'll sure give it my best shot. I've never done it before, but that doesn't mean I can't do it. Let me see how I can figure this thing out." Take the attitude of the old fellow, you know, he was on his 100th birthday, and some smart aleck said, "Well, Gramp, you going to try for 200? He said, "Well, let's put it this way." He said, "I'm a lot stronger than I was on my first one." Some other smart aleck came up to him and said, "Gramp, can you play the piano?" He said, "I don't know." And he said, "What do you mean you don't know?" He said, "I never tried." Now, you see, traditionally, a lot of people would say, "Well, no, I don't know." "Why? I've never tried." Then how do you know you can't if you've never tried? If there's an occasion, I say give it your best shot. When you do the things you ought to do, when you ought to do them, you will eventually be able to do the things you want to do when you want to do them. Very significant. Do it now. If you've got an assignment that you don't want to do, do it now. You'll get it done sooner and with less hassle. They'll probably praise you when you do, but if you delay starting, they will criticize you almost regardless of what happens as a result of you doing it. Stay with it. Persistence is important. I know you heard the one that Dr. Charles Lowry tells about the fellow who had never done real well in life, and he finally conceived of an idea for a new soft drink. And he called it 4-Up. Well, he put a good marketing effort behind it, you know, but it just didn't quite click. So he went back to the drawing board, and he worked some more and really spent a considerable amount of time and effort and money on it, and he came back with 5-Up. And again, it was close, but it just didn't quite have it. And then one more time he gave it a shot, and this time he made the supreme effort, and he called it 6-Up. Well, that one didn't quite make it either, and he threw in the towel. If he'd only known how close he was. Now, like a lot of humorous stories, this one has a lesson in it. Make failure your teacher, not your undertaker. A detour, not a dead-end street. Learn to love your work. And, you know, the interesting thing is, I believe we can learn to love our work with an adjustment in our attitude and looking at it as to what we like to do and how we can improve on whatever the job is. Charles Kettering, for a number of years, was a section foreman with General Motors. And he once had an opportunity. A bum came to him while they were on the job, and the bum asked him for money for lunch. Mr. Kettering said, "No, I won't give you money for lunch, but I will take you to lunch." So he took him to lunch and bought him a good lunch. And the man said, "Now, you know, I really am not accustomed to begging. I would like to work for you in order to pay you back for the meal." And Mr. Kettering said, "All right," said, "let's come over here and I've got something I'll get you to do." And it was simply to dig a hole in the ground that they had a need for right there. And Charles Kettering showed him how to dig a hole. He showed him exactly how to square it away, how to make certain it was perfectly straight, how to make certain it was perfectly level. And as Charles Kettering was digging the hole and showing the man, he demonstrated a considerable amount of pride in the way the hole ought to be dug in the ground. And then the man took over, and he started working on it, and he did a magnificent job. So good, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Kettering gave him a job. Later on, the man became a foreman for him. And the man said to Mr. Kettering, "You know, had anybody showed me early in life the importance of doing whatever you do well and taking pride in whatever you do, then I never would have been without a job." Work gives us more than a living. Work gives us our life. You perhaps have heard the story, but there's so much truth in it, I'll share it with you again. Years ago in the Smoky Mountains, some domestic hogs got loose, several of them, and they started living in the wilds. Over a period of a number of generations, they got progressively wilder and wilder until they had so adjusted to the area that they were as wild as any hog could possibly be. And they were very dangerous. So the local people decided they needed to figure out a way to get rid of them. So they hired hunters, but the hogs were extraordinarily smart, and they never could kill the hogs. And so one day an old man showed up in the village there on the top of this mountainside, and he had a donkey cart, and there was some lumber in the back of the donkey cart and some grain. And he announced to the curious people around that he was going up on the mountain to catch the hogs. Well, they kind of laughed at the old man, and he said, "Well, don't worry about it. I'll be back with the hogs and let you know where I've got them trapped." Well, about 3 weeks later, he came back down and said, "Well, if you go up such and such a place, you'll find them all enclosed in this pen." And they said, "Well, how on earth did you manage to do it?" He said, "Well, the first thing I did when I got up there," he said, "I just simply laid the lumber out on the ground, and then I spread some of the grain." Now, the old boar who was in charge was watching all of this from out in the woods, and he led the sows and the little pigs up with him, and they sniffed around there, and it probably took them a couple of hours before they were willing to take a bite of that grain. It was there, and it was good, and it was free, and so they took a bite. He said, the next day I went back, I dug four post holes, and I simply put a post up in either one of those, and I put more grain right in the center. And he said, they were skeptical at first, but there the grain was, just like before. And he said, by doing that, over a period of about 2 weeks, I gradually built a fence up and set the trap door, and then I put a lot of the grain in there, and sure enough, the lure of something for nothing, the free lunch, had captured them. They walked in, I sprung the lock. See, that to me really tells us a great deal. It says that when you make a wild animal dependent upon man for his food, you destroy his resourcefulness and he's in trouble. You do exactly the same thing when you treat man that way. That's the real difficulty with much of the welfare in our society. The tragedy of this country has been the treatment we have accorded the American Indian over a period of our country's history. We signed any number of treaties with them. We have said, lay down your arms and we will, quote, take care of you. We put them on reservations. And all you've got to do is go to the reservations and you will see what Uncle Sam means when he says, I'll take care of you. I'll tell you, I don't believe there's anybody that's a bigger flag waver than old Zig, as I will share with you a little bit later. But if you want to create a cripple, just give a man a pair of crutches for a few months, or give him a free lunch long enough for him to get in the habit of getting something for nothing. It's old but true. You give a man a fish and you feed him for the day. But if you'll teach him to fish, you will literally feed him for life. When you give a man a dole, you deny him his dignity and you rob him of his destiny.